In this episode, we speak with Nader Naini, managing partner of Fraser Healthcare Partners. Nader joined the firm in 1991 and has served on Fraser's management committee, investment committee, and led its growth buyout practice since 1995. Under his leadership, the growth buyout team has scaled from an initial team of 4 to over 60 and raised over $5 billion in AUM from institutional limited partners globally. During his over 3-decade tenure with the firm, he has been responsible for and served on the boards of numerous successful investments, including Aspen Education Group, CHG Healthcare, Priority Solutions International, Bravo Health, Laboratory Supply Company, Pentec Health, Solis Mammography, DSI Renal, Northfield Medical, and United Digestive. He currently serves on the boards of Elevate Patient Financial Solutions, Acuity Delivery Systems, and Effective School Solutions. I'm your host, RJ Lumba. We hope you enjoy the show. If you like the episode, click to follow.
RJ Lumba is the managing partner of Growth Cap and the executive chairman of Market Insight Media. He is the host of Growth Investor, a podcast featuring today's best investors, executives, and founders. In the minutes ahead, we'll uncover insights and strategies for accelerating growth and succeeding in business.
Nader, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's a delight to be with you.
Thank you for having me.
So I've been anxiously awaiting this conversation. I've known about Fraser for a long time, and who better to speak with than the person who has helped really grow this firm since inception. Tell us about 1991, when you first got started. How did it all come to be?
Well, I think I would first start and say it was an audacious idea for us to think that we're going to start a private equity firm in Seattle, Washington, 1991. There wasn't much other than Microsoft, maybe Costco, a few other companies going on in Seattle. But much to the credit of the founder and my partner for many years, Alan Fraser, we decided that it made sense to start a fund that was dedicated to healthcare in Seattle, which rare, frankly. Sector-specific funds today are much more prevalent. And the rationale behind that is generally when you're immersed in a particular industry, you tend to know more about it and maybe make wiser decisions from an investment perspective. Back then, most LPs were looking at investing in a fund that was in many different verticals and created diversification by virtue of that. And today that's kind of been pulled apart. Now people make their own decisions as to who the best managers in each vertical are. We were very fortunate to have some big supporters of ours early on, a gentleman named Ken Langone, who was one of the founders of Home Depot, and the Pritzker family out of Chicago. Both were big supporters. So when we didn't have much credibility, we had two folks that were really helpful in generating some of that credibility. Ultimately, the rationale behind a sector-specific fund was that healthcare is obviously a very large market, $1 trillion maybe at the time, today growing to $3 trillion. And highly regulated, very nuanced. And frankly, if you weren't immersed in it day to day, I think you might miss certain aspects, certain long-term trends, certain things that might play into your favor. So we kind of got started in 91 and the firm has evolved. We started early where we had two strategies in one fund. One was our traditional early stage investing in life sciences. So developing new drugs, series A through D. And that's 40% of the allocation of the fund. And the other 60% was in what I kind of lead today and we're here to talk about is our growth buyout fund part of the strategy. And that's much more companies that are generating anywhere from 10 to 75 million of EBITDA. So very established. And what we can do to take those companies and grow them and build them into market leaders.
You know, it's easy to look back and say like, oh yeah, that was the right decision to make, you know, like see how successful we've been. But at the time, and it seemed like you were just exiting business school, it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, but was it a tough decision at the time?
Well, it was a really tough decision. I'll tell you for a variety of reasons. When I graduated from undergrad, I had applied to medical school. My dad was a doctor. My brother was a neurosurgeon going through residency at Mass General. And I had the aspiration of becoming the team doctor of the Seahawks. That was my goal. So I applied to medical school. I was a molecular biology undergrad, got into medical school, and a little bit of a whim, I took a job interview with a firm that I frankly didn't know much about, Goldman Sachs, on campus. And so, you know, serendipitously at some level got a job offer and went back to my folks and said, I think I'm going to forego medical school, watching my brother go through his residency. I wasn't sure I quite had the passion for it as much as he did to go through it. And much to their chagrin, I ended up going to work at Goldman. So it really kind of, at that point, I thought I knew something. I thought I was going to be interested in finance. And then over a longer period of time, that energy and excitement and passion around finance really was developed. So for me, it kind of started later. And when I came back to Seattle, I would tell you there wasn't a lot going on in Seattle. I had two job offers when I got back here in 91. I picked geography over opportunity, frankly. One was with a fledgling little privately held coffee company called Starbucks. And it, you know, I wasn't a big coffee drinker. So the notion of getting a couple of pounds of free coffee every week wasn't a great incentive. I was going to work with a CFO to hedge forward coffee exposure and do M&A, but I really wanted to do something in healthcare. And when Alan and I connected, he was the sole employee of the firm. And he and I talked and I said, this is what I want to do. So
that's incredible. And so it's been over three decades. You know, Fraser has developed a very prestigious reputation. What do you attribute that to? What are some of the key elements to you building the firm to what it is today?
I think first and foremost is culture, and culture starts from the top. And I think Alan set a real terrific culture, and I kind of grew up in that. And so I was immersed in it. And what is the culture? In fact, I think it's on our website. We say we want everybody we touch along the way to be better off because of the interaction with us than they were before. And it kind of sounds a little corny, but it's the truth. And I think we've been fortunate enough to be able to recruit people that have bought into that culture. So as we've gone from one and two people to now over 80 people, that's the type of character and kind of type of trait that we want in the organization. And that's not necessarily, you know, I would say prevalent in the private equity world. And I think by virtue of that and 32 years of investment in that sort of culture, there's a lot of reputational capital that's been accrued over that period of time that generates value for us. And so it's kind of feeding on itself now. It's a lot easier today than it was, you know, maybe many years ago. But we've always done the right thing for every constituency, whether that meant it was going to be detrimental to our position or not. We did the right thing. And I think that that's paid off in spades over a long period.
Now, the other interesting aspect about how you approach investing is that you're very thesis driven. And from what I read, you conduct these biannual events. Tell us about what occurs and how often you're encountering like these new areas and themes to go after.
I think we're very fortunate in that this ecosystem that we've developed over 32 years and the relationships that we've developed over these 32 years, again, help us identify interesting long-term trends in healthcare. And frankly, as important, if not more important, identify really talented, high-quality executives that could run these companies. And so the ability to source really high quality people and really high quality ideas is born through a number of different approaches. Once a year, we have a very significant group, call it 40 or 50 thought leaders in healthcare that join us in Montana. And these are folks that are CEOs of large health systems, you know, head of Amazon or Disney's global health benefits, publicly traded companies, privately traded companies, but people that are thought leaders in healthcare. I call it a little bit of a mini Allen conference for healthcare. And we come with three or four themes that we think are interesting. And we ask them as part of their admission to this august group to come with an answer to this question. If you had $100 to $200 million and you had to invest it in healthcare and it couldn't be the areas that you were actively participating, where would you invest and why? And so over a three-day period, not only did we develop relationships and friendships with these folks that I think bear value over the long term, but also we generate real interesting nuggets of ideas of where we think the market is going and where we might want to participate. And then we ourselves do a lot of primary research around those ideas to determine whether there's a thesis in there that we should really pursue.
So could we get the cliff notes, or generally, what areas do you think are really interesting to look at?
Well, I think, look, cost containment and really looking at investing in opportunities which are able to bend the cost curve employers is an interesting area. I think you're starting to see significant inflation where they just can't continue to invest this much of their P&L in healthcare. And as such, I think that's an area that we've been looking a lot at. Pharma services is an area that we've been particularly successful at. We continue to invest in. Pharmaceutical companies, life science companies are particularly good in their core competency, which is developing new drugs. A lot of the services that ultimately deliver those drugs are not necessarily their core competency. And I think there's terrific opportunity around that. It's a very large and growing market. And I think the other piece of healthcare that is historically been set up this way is a very labor intensive business model. US health system is very labor intensive. And as such, automation is an opportunity to bring to that market and really take costs out of the system, which is, I think, good for the consumers of healthcare as well as the payers of healthcare. So those are some of the areas we're focused on.
And is it the case where you'll always kind of assign one of your executives and residents to a portco? How does that typically work?
So our model is a little bit different than most. And I think we kind of turn it on its head. A lot of groups will sit, wait, they'll get a book from an intermediary. They'll look through it and they say, wow, this is a really interesting investment opportunity. Let's dig in. Let's get to meet management. In 90 days, you're the proud owner of a new company and you've met management maybe two or three times. Our view is we develop investment theses. We're not trying to boil the ocean, where we say we want to go and focus on this particular area. We then leverage our network of 32 years to identify a previously private equity backed CEO in that space who's been operating. And we test our thesis with that individual. And to the extent that the thesis is affirmed, we will partner with that individual to then go spend the next 6 to 12 months looking for an asset for them to run. It'll serve as the platform from which they will drop into and run. So at any point in time, we have 3 to 5 of these executive and residence initiatives ongoing. We've historically had about 80% conversion rate. So it really drives the deal sourcing for us. That doesn't mean we don't look at everything else that's in the market, but we're going to spend the vast majority of our time on kind of this engine that's driving kind of ideas and pairing that with people looking for assets.
Is there a good example of how that's worked? Maybe a case study, so to speak?
Sure. I'll give you one. I was called by a lawyer out of New York, a relationship we had, and said, hey, I've got a client that has a large business that was itself was spun out of a publicly traded company. And it had a division that no longer was core to their overall business or their strategy. And so we ended up, he said, look, it fits kind of the profile and size and type of company you want. It's in pharma services. It provides packaging services to the pharmaceutical industry, et cetera. What he didn't share with me, and this is my friend in air quotes, was that it had gone through multiple failed processes, didn't really have a management team. It had declined by over 80% in terms of the bottom line. And so it needed some work. I think this is kind of a great example of how things work for us and how the ecosystem is leveraged. I ended up calling one of our senior advisors who happened to be the president of the company that this bigger entity was spun out of. And I said, Mark, who used to run this business when it was part of your business? And he said, there's a gentleman that he introduced us to. And we said, Bill, would you like to come and take a look at this asset with us? Because you know it better than anybody. And long story short, when we looked at it, he came out and said, look, there's nothing wrong with this business. I think I can take it back to its prior glory days. And I will reconstitute the team that did that when it was part of this other larger publicly traded company. So the long story short, it was an orphaned asset within a larger company that we carved out. Bill took the reins as CEO the day we acquired it. He reconstituted the band that took us to its primary glory days and took it from a $10 million earnings business to a $110 million earnings business over the next 4 to 5 years. So the moral of the story is not that it was a great investment, but without the relationships, we would have been just like every other private equity firm in America, which said, this is too messy, not very exciting. We're not going to touch this. Today, that company is the market leader globally owned by a different private equity firm in that space.
Mm-hmm. You know, I can imagine that when you experience that type of success, where you're able to bring along kind of one of these orphaned assets and make it into a category leader, that you think, let's rinse and repeat that. How else can we do it? Is there a certain segment, or maybe it's like a predominant feature of Frazier, but is this something you actively go after?
Oh, 100%. First, not only rinse and repeat with the executives we've backed, 50% of the executives in our existing portfolio, the CEOs of our portfolio companies, are second time or third time CEOs that we've backed. That's a massive risk mitigant as you think about investing in companies, and you speak the same language, you trust one another, you quickly kind of get to the right answers and work together. So I think that's one piece of it. The other piece is we've made quite a few investments in that pharma services space. In fact, Bill Mitchell, the gentleman who ran that business for us, was an exec chair on another company and said, guys, you need to look at this company. It was owned by another private equity firm because it reminds me very much of the other company that you backed. And so we got out in front of that, and we ultimately made an investment in that company. So as I said, if you think about how dots are connected, at the end of the day, this is a people business. If I learned one thing in over 30 years of doing this, is relationships matter in every business, particularly in this, and they lead to other investment opportunities. And they sometimes are proprietary investment opportunities because of the relationship you've developed.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to something you said earlier in the conversation about culture and the way you interact with each person you encounter. One of the reasons why I first started Growth Cap was because, this is going back over 20 years, I would meet a lot of different firms and I would see a big difference in the way managing partners and partners approached portfolio companies and the way they help scale those companies. What would you say are like the defining characteristics of the people you bring in and what you try to kind of impart on them as they go about deal making?
Integrity, hard work, positive energy, transparency. I call things like I see it. I don't know any other way. And I think that after a while, people respect that and understand it. At first, they come and they're like, this is a little bit different, because I think having humility is important as well. I can assure you, over the 32 years, I've made some mistakes. Not every one of our investments have been perfect, but the reality is you learn from it and you move on. And so what we try and do is really kind of let that sort of feeling and vibe permeate the organization. We encourage our younger people to speak up. We want them to have a voice. In fact, when we're in portfolio meetings and we're talking about deals, we start from youngest and move forward, kind of most junior people and move forward, because I don't want my opinion to drive, or any of the senior people's opinions to kind of drive the discussion into a particular direction. I think that's the strength of the partnership, as we all come from different backgrounds. We have different risk utility curves. We have different views of the world. And I think what you do is you pull that all into the center, and then you figure out what is the right answer.
Excellent. We're approaching the tail end here, and I have two questions I like to end with. One is, can you tell us about a person who has had a profound influence on you?
Well, other than my family, parents and whatnot, and I'd say that, you know, there's a number of folks that have been instrumental in getting me to where I am today. I'd say Alan Frazier, my partner for over 30 plus years, and he's now retired, but he's still someone that's a sounding board that I call and bounce things off of. And then probably Ken Langone, who's also a mentor of mine. I call a mentor of mine. I see him regularly in New York City and we chat, and he's a big personality. But really, those are folks that kind of help shape how I work with people, how we relate to people, how we treat people. And I think that's really important, because at the end of the day, what's your legacy? It's your reputation and how you treated people along the way and how they feel about you. So those are two I'd say I'd throw out there as real exemplary as far as how I've led my life.
Last question. Can you tell us about a charity, cause, or other endeavor that you're passionate about?
Well, my family is involved in an active number of charities focused on supporting lesser privileged children. So we believe kind of get involved with people early. And we don't really talk a lot about it because we do it because we like to do it. And we think it's the right thing to do is to give back to people because we've been given so much along the way. And people supported us to get us to where we are today. So it really takes a village in many instances. So I believe in that. I think the other thing I love to do is really mentor younger folks that are coming up the ranks. In fact, I just this past weekend, I had someone who literally cold emailed me. No idea who this individual is. It was a young, very, what I call energetic entrepreneur who works for a very prominent VC firm in the Silicon Valley and said, listen, I've got this great idea in healthcare. And would you be willing to spend a few minutes on the phone? Because I want to run it by you just given your background. So I will take those sorts of calls when they show resourcefulness, initiative, and very thoughtful kind of approach in terms of how they're coming at you. So I ended up spending an hour and a half on the phone with this kid. And you know, that gave me energy. I was giving him all sorts of views and ideas, thoughts that I hopefully will be helpful to him. But it also energized me. I try to do a lot of that over the years because I think, again, there was a lot of people that helped me get to where I'm at. And if I see someone that is really trying, I want to be supportive and helpful to them as well.
You know, one quick add-on, we do have a fair number of investors that listen in on this. And that, you know, it's not uncommon that they'll spin out of their own firm and start their own. What one piece of advice would you give someone who's looking to set up their own private equity, growth equity firm?
Perseverance. Don't let setbacks dissuade you from keep marching forward. I mean, if we look back 32 years ago, as I said, it's an audacious idea to start a private equity firm in Seattle, Washington. And today, we're one of the largest healthcare sector specific funds in the country. And so I would tell you there was lots of missteps and speed bumps along the way. And you learn from them and you keep marching forward. So in my mind, it's a test of your perseverance and hard work, all the things that you know. But there's real life examples along the way where I kind of scratched my head and said, are we going to be able to make it through this? And you do. You put your head down, you figure it out.
Excellent. That's a good note to end on, encouraging note for those certain listeners out there. Nader, thank you so much for taking the time. This has been a wonderful conversation.
RJ, pleasure. Thank you. I look forward to speaking again.